It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Wisconsin Life.
First, yesterday marked 1 year since 18-year-old Michael Brown was killed by white police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. Following his death, demonstrations began in Ferguson and spread around the country, aimed at addressing issues of policing practices, criminal justice, and racism.
In the years since Brown's death, news of several other unarmed black men killed by white police officers has occupied headlines, from Eric Garner in New York City to Tony Robinson here in Wisconsin.
This weekend, Michael Brown was memorialized in Ferguson with peaceful demonstrations and a concert. Last night, however, some violence did break out close to demonstrators. Here with us now to talk about the events of the past weekend is Duri Buscarin, reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. Duri, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, what was the atmosphere like at this weekend's events memorializing Michael Brown?
The overall sort of feeling of the weekend was one of peace, one of retrospection. There's a lot of anger and tension over the fact that things aren't moving as quickly as a lot of people would like to see. But, most of these events went off without a hitch. On Sunday, there was a march led by the father of Michael Brown through the Canfield Green apartment area near the scene of the shooting. And a concert with some actually really major rap artists later that night in St. Louis.
And who took part in the memorializations, the demonstrations that there were this weekend?
Well, I think that a lot of people came in from out of town. There's been a very a core group of demonstrators who are regularly at these protests. But some of the protest leaders that have gone on to other cities, including DeRay McKesson and Jonetta Elvey, returned to St. Louis for the events.
And how have the demonstrations and their messages changed in the year since Michael Brown was killed?
I think that they're actually still very much the same. I think that it's expanded to include all these other officer-involved shootings that we've had in the past. I know that the Sandra Bland case was, caused a lot of anger among people and worries, really. And I think that as things go along, it's kind of evolved into a discussion of best practices for policing and really the depth of racial disparities in this country and the challenges to address them.
Now, you said that there was some frustration that things hadn't progressed further than they have in the year that's gone by. Have you talked to people and heard what they're saying about what they'd like to be moving faster and what areas they think are still problematic?
That's a good question. I think that a lot of residents in Ferguson see that the community has really come back together, but they see a lot of the same people in the city offices, and they see, there was a new election, and so a couple community members did, replace other people on the city council, but there's a Ferguson commission that's been having meetings and talking about how to sort of correct these historic issues, but they're sort of limited in their power of what they can do, and I think that there's some tension around that.
And Ferguson itself, how has that changed, particularly when it comes to law enforcement and the way that it interacts with the community that it serves?
Well, there's definitely a new focus on community-based policing. I know that a lot of police departments have done this, but there's definitely a renewed focus. The idea of that is that a police officer shouldn't meet you for the first time when you're a suspect or when you're a victim. And it's kind of having them be in the community, getting to know residents. There's been an effort towards hiring police officers who are not white and women particularly. There's been the chief of police has stepped down and has been replaced in Ferguson. And so I think that there are a lot of changes that have been made.
We're speaking right now with Duri Buscarin. She's a reporter at St. Louis Public Radio, talking about the weekend's events in Ferguson. Yesterday marked 1 year since Michael Brown was killed by a white police officer, sparking demonstrations around the country. And what are people saying? You mentioned these changes in how the police force is working on community-based policing, meeting people, being out there and being part of the community, bringing in women, for instance. Is it making a difference? Is it moving the needle?
It's really hard to measure that, I think. I mean, I spoke with a resident I've gotten to know well, and she said that just recently her sister was stopped in her car for driving a vehicle that she said that the officer said fit the description for someone who had been selling drugs in the area. But it's a pretty common vehicle. And I've also seen that the issue of ticketing, that municipalities in the St. Louis region, very similar to Ferguson and including Ferguson, tend to get a lot of their income from speeding tickets and arrest warrants that tend to build up very quickly and tend to be really expensive for people who don't have the means. And it doesn't seem like that has really slowed down at all.
Now, the demonstrations were by and large peaceful, although last night some violence did break out. What happened last night?
Right. So I was there probably around 10:30, 11 p.m., and around 11:20, the protest had been dying down. It was probably a quarter of the size that it had once been, maybe 50 people, a lot of the media, and then a lot of police officers lined up in riot gear on West Florissant. They had closed down the road after reports of break-ins at some of the stores earlier. And probably about a block away, around that time, just this series of gunfire went off. And it was really hard to tell where it was coming from or what was happening, but it was definitely dozens of shots. And when that started happening, I mean, gunfire has occurred at these protests before, and people just, you know, ducked for cover or ran. And I just remember seeing, like, these kids running in the crowd, and an older woman was next to me. And so that was, I think, really terrifying for a lot of people because it was just so close. It seems like this weekend we've had some violence sort of on the periphery of protests. A couple photographers at the local newspaper here said that they were, robbed, and one was actually, it seemed like he was roughed up by people in the crowd or near the crowd. But the difference with this shooting is that it happened so close. And what happened was it was two groups of people separated from the protest who were shooting at each other. And then a young man, I guess, that police had been following and knew was armed, ran down the street. Four undercover officers followed him. They report that he turned around and shot at them, and so they shot him. And he is, as far the last we've heard, is he was in critical condition at a local hospital.
Now, it sounds like there was some fear when this happened last night, people running. Once it became clear what the situation was, how did protesters react? Did they return to their protesting and still hold on to that threat of peace and hope and optimism that maybe they were trying to go for? Or was there a sense, here we go again?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the fascinating thing about protests, is there are so many different people and so many different personalities and thoughts. And so you see a lot of different things happening in that time. I mean, there were clergy members who, like this little tiny blonde woman who went immediately to the, there was a woman who had collapsed and was just grieving, and apparently it was a family member or a girlfriend, and the reverend went and comforted her and made sure she could get into a car. And there were other protesters sort of trying to calm people down and keep the peace. Others left or had a hard time leaving because they were concerned that it would be unsafe to walk to their cars. Probably about an hour after the shooting, there was sort of a huddle of the remaining protesters, and I would guess there were 30 people. And there was a lot of anger that an officer-involved shooting had happened on the anniversary of the death of Michael Brown.
We heard some chanting during the NPR newscast, "The world is watching." Is there still a sense in Ferguson that there is a mantle of responsibility there, that the world is watching?
Maybe. I mean, if you're in Ferguson, you'll meet reporters from all over the world, and you'll see reports from the BBC and from different, I mean, there's a group of Russian journalists that have been there for a while. And yes, I think that a lot of residents of Ferguson feel that their hometown has been portrayed inaccurately as this kind of haven of violence, and particularly with racial tensions. And a lot of people say, no, this is one of the few diverse communities in the St. Louis region. Yes, there are issues. They didn't realize they were so deep-seated, and now they're kind of coming to terms with it and trying to make Ferguson a better place. I think that there's a lot of residents who are really making an effort to do that.
Dury, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Dury Buscarin, reporter at St. Louis Public Radio, talking about this weekend's events in Ferguson, Missouri. Yesterday marked 1 year since Michael Brown was killed by a white police officer, sparking off demonstrations around the country.
Artists can draw inspiration from just about anywhere. A few years ago in Madison, middle school teacher and artist Joe Jensen found hers piled on the counter of a local tavern.
I got divorced a few years ago. Oh, God, 4 years ago now. And at the time, it was sort of like, oh, man, I can't stay home here all alone. I got to get out. So these friends said, oh, you got to come with us to Chiefs. It's really fun. It's really fun. We usually go there on Tuesdays. Chiefs is a really nice bar, tavern. There's kind of an ambiance in there that reminds me of bars up north. So I started hanging out with them, and they have pull tab machine, and you know, it was kind of like everybody buy pull tabs. These pull tabs are about 1/2 by maybe 3.5 inches, and there's 5 little tabs on them. You peel back the tabs, and under the tabs there's all these little icons, and if you get 3 of the same, you win some money. And depending upon what the icon is, that tells you if you won $1 or $200. Anyhow, people were doing these pull tab things, and you're sitting at the bar getting a shine on, talking to your friends, having laughs, la la la. And, you know, I'm sitting there looking at these things, and when you put them together after they've been opened, they almost look like fish scales. They thought, you know, because there were so many of them. I mean, they were piling up on the bar, and I thought, my God, I could make something out of these. So the first thing I made was this big bass jumping out of the water, chomping a wallet that had a $100 bill coming out of it. That was the first one. It was a very realistic looking fish, except that it had pull tabs for scales. So from then on, it was kind of like each of the pieces I've done are kind of a cautionary tale about gambling. So that one was the big one that got away. You know, people say that like they're gambling. Oh, I'm going to win. And then, you know, nope. That was a big one that got away. Yeah, there's the mermaid, the siren, calls of sailors into the rocks, right? There's another fish assemblage where it's a large fish eating a smaller fish, eating smaller fish. And there's a quote from George Bernard Shaw about the many must lose so the few may win. Oh, then there's the dragon. If you look at it, the way that it winds around is a dollar bill sign.
Oh, right.
Okay, chasing the dragon. Plus, what's cool about it is first, it's making something out of nothing, pretty much. It's out of making something out of loss. I didn't have to pay for it. And, you know, I'm a little cheap. You don't do art because of money. You do art because you have to, and that's what it is for me. I mean, it's what gives me solace after a really vile week. And man, if somebody buys some stuff, that's just the icing on the cake. It's great. Then I buy myself some cool shoes or something. You know?
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more, you can go to wisconsinlife.org.
Moving on from making art of something that a lot of us would just consider trash, let's talk about a form of street art that's been around for years, chalk art. This Saturday, the sidewalks of the UW-Eau Claire campus will be filled with chalk artists from around the state competing for prizes and for pride.
Joining us now to tell us more about Chalk Fest is Lindsay Quinnies, Program Manager for Volume 1 Magazine in Eau Claire. Lindsay, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Lindsay, what is the history of this chalk art that's going to go on in Eau Claire?
Sure. Well, just the art form in general dates back to like 16th century Renaissance Italy. 1972 is about when the big chalk art festivals really came to be a thing. The first one started in a small town in Italy. We've been doing Chalk Fest in Eau Claire since 2008, so this will be the 8th year that we're doing it in town.
Yeah, how did Eau Claire adopt this concept that had been around for a while?
Yeah, we have a lot. There's a great artistic abundance in our community, and a lot of that art seems to be in art galleries and in kind of exclusive places where you have to go seek it out. And we really wanted to put it in a place, literally take it to the streets and have these artists have a chance to be out in public and have people in the community come and experience the art and put it just in front of the community and not just in galleries and more exclusive places. So that's what kind of started it, is just there's this great artistic energy in our community, and we really just wanted to showcase that.
And I imagine one of the cool things is being able to watch the artists while they work.
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the biggest parts of Chalk Fest. I think that's what people really enjoy, is seeing the pieces kind of come together throughout the day.
And how big are these pieces?
It depends. We're switching venues than we have in past years, so we have different sizes of sidewalk squares available. We have 6x6 up to a 12x12 in the space that we're working in this year, so you can kind of choose the space that you want to work in as an artist.
And are you getting mostly artists, people who do art for a living, community members with an artistic flair, or just kind of a combination of the two?
A combination, for sure. We definitely have some fine artists that do it for a living that participate every year. And then we have people that just kind of want to be a part of the experience, that either do art as a hobby or just want to be a part of it, that take part in it as well.
And so these chalk artists, do they usually start by having an outline, or is it more organic than that, and they just sort of start creating and see what comes out?
Yeah, it kind of depends as well. We have a lot of people that will grid out their space and have a good plan for how to accomplish the piece that they want to accomplish throughout the day. But we've had other artists that come and just, they don't really have a plan, and they just create something in the space that day and spur the moment. So it varies.
So, Lindsay, paint us a picture, I guess, chalk us a picture. What's it like to walk around when all this art is in place? So what happens to your town when it's all there?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. People get really into it. Some of the artists just get really into the gritty aspect of being covered in chalk all day and just kind of immerse themselves in the piece. So that's really fun to watch. And I think, like I said, the community just gets a kick out of seeing the pieces be created throughout the day. Artists get there as early as 7 a.m. to start their pieces, and some of them even want to come in sooner. And we're there. We don't do awards until 6 or 7 at night that day. So some of them are working on it for hours and hours throughout the day. So it's really neat to see, you know, the pieces come to life.
Now, this is sort of a temporary kind of art by nature. It's outside. It's in the elements. You get a rainy weekend, or even if it's up for the whole weekend and then you get a thunderstorm going through, it's washed away. How do you deal with that, the temporary nature of the art that's being created?
We just kind of play it by ear. We've been really lucky the past few years that we haven't had to, you know, we haven't had a day where we're just not capable of doing it. But we've had days where there's been, you know, sprinkles throughout the day and where you kind of have to take a break, but it's we leave it up until the rain washes away. There's not a time that we go and remove it or that it's removed by the city. It just stays up until it's naturally gone, which is kind of neat, because we leave the whole next day open as kind of an informal tour of it all, like a gallery.
And you mentioned judging, and there are prizes, Lindsay. How does judging work for all the chalk art once it's in place?
Sure. We select different judges every year. We've had some that have done it more than once, but we work with different local and regional artists for judging, people that own art galleries in town. University professors have done it before. Different, like, a couple tattoo artists have done it in town before. So we just get about three or four judges different every year that come, and there's categories. There's adult and youth categories, and then there's individual and group categories. And then there is just like a popular vote. So everybody that comes to watch can vote for a piece that they like, and then it's broken down like that, adult versus youth and group versus individual. And we have different cash prizes and gift certificates that we give to all the winners.
Can you participate even if you're not really any good? You just like the idea of drawing on the sidewalk?
Definitely. We don't have any requirements. There's no prerequisites. You can go online and register. You just go to volume1.org/chalkfest, and there'll be a tab right at the top to register, and you fill out the form with what size square you want, and anyone can really enter.
And in years past, how long has the art remained in place before it got washed away?
Yeah, we've had some really lucky years where it'll last about a week and we haven't don't get any rain, and then it's great because the longer it'll last, the better. We've had a couple years where it gets, you know, washed away pretty quick the next day. So we just kind of hope for the best and hope it stays as long as possible.
I don't want to make you play favorites, but is there an especially cool chalk drawing that you've seen, a favorite?
Oh, not really. Nothing in particular. There's different ones every year. There hasn't been a lot of repeats. It's always different. So it's neat to see the different kinds of things that come out every year.
Lindsay, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, no problem.
Lindsay Quinnis is the program manager for Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire. We've been talking about Chalk Fest, which happens this Saturday on the UW-Eau Claire campus. I guess Wausau had something like this earlier in the summer, too. I'd love to see one of these, but I probably wouldn't do the drawing. I don't
Anyone
have a lot of
can
talent.
Participate, yeah.
Right. I mean, if you want to see a bunch of stick figures or something, I guess I could get into that. I don't draw well in any medium.
Well, my children have been doing some chalk art outside the house.
Yeah.
You can stop by and you'll be in good company.
Excellent.
If you want
Our
to join
own
in.
Mini chalk fest.
I got money, marbles, and chalk, sweetheart, but I still feel like I am.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the VA Office of the Inspector General released a new report blaming the death of a Marine veteran on care given at the Toma VA Center. We'll talk to a reporter who covers military issues about the latest news.
First, Wisconsin has a new political party. It's the Wisconsin Working Families Party, a branch of the National Party that promotes progressive policies and candidates, and it's now active in 9 states.
The party does not have ballot status in Wisconsin, so you won't be able to see the name at polling stations in the next election, but they do plan to run candidates in nonpartisan elections in Milwaukee and back candidates in Democratic Party primaries.
Here with us now is Marina Dmitrievich. She's state director of the Wisconsin Working Families Party. Marina, thanks for joining us today.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Why do you think Wisconsin needed a new progressive-oriented party?
Well, I think working families across the nation have seen that the major parties are not doing a good enough job to stand up for people who are struggling to make ends meet. And we plan on being a champion who's unafraid and will deliver results for working families.
And when I think political party, the first thing that pops into my mind is a ballot with the name of that party on it and the candidate next to it. That's not your vision for the short run. Do you see that in the future?
I do see it in the future. Places like Oregon and New York have already seen fusion-style voting, and it's been very successful. But for right now, an entity that's actually been really successful at this without ballot status has been the Tea Party. And while that's in the hands of a few wealthy individuals, we obviously stand for something totally opposite, but we plan to operate with similar type of a brand.
Have you seen shortcomings in the state's Democratic Party, the one of the big parties I imagine that you would see as closer to your values?
Right. I belong to the Democratic Party. I have for many years. I'm recently cast my vote in the new race for chair. So I think that the Democratic Party has done a lot. And what we're looking to do is not necessarily attack the party, but attack corporate Democrats who have been unwilling to be true champions for issues like economic and racial justice, just to name a few.
So, for example, would you try to recruit a candidate to run against some of those candidates in a primary election?
That might be the case. Right now, we are very focused on the February and April elections that are nonpartisan in Milwaukee. We certainly will branch out to Madison and Dane County and eventually across the state, but look, we have a message that resonates with the 99%, and there's a whole lot of 99% out there. So we feel that we've already received a lot of positivity and energy and feedback, and we plan to bring out some new people to the ballot box.
Are there Democratic politicians presently here in the state that you would point to as an example of, I think you said, corporate Democrats that you think might deserve a challenge from the left in a primary?
Well, if we had more time, I'd go down the entire list, but I'll tell you a couple that stand out. We have our own Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who runs as a Democrat, and very difficult to make that argument. And then we also, in Milwaukee County, have what I like to call Mr. 1%, and that is County Executive Chris Abele, who has not stood up for working families at all in Milwaukee County. So though there's certainly some popular figures that I think need a challenge from a champion.
What kind of policy platforms would you be advocating for in the Working Families Party?
So we work on big issues like economic inequality, racial justice, climate change, debt-free higher education. Again, anything that can help working families get an edge and actually support and thrive and access the working middle class and even higher class. A signature piece is raising wages to $15 an hour with a union, as well as guaranteeing paid sick days.
We're talking to Marina Dmitrievich. She is with the Working Families, the new chair of the new branch of the Working Families Party here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for her about the party. Your thoughts, do you think the state needs a party like the one she's talking about? Why or why not? 800-642-1234 is the number. We have a caller already. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks so much. You know, I find a lot of times that there are people who try to define themselves, whether fiscally conservative or liberally, or socially conservative or liberally, and they often have conflicting views for the party, for one or the other party. How would you view your party? Would it be fiscally conservative or liberal, and socially liberal or conservative, or other aspects that could help lead someone towards your party?
Thanks for the call, Charlie. Marina. Yeah.
All right. Great. That was a quick turnaround. So, you know, some things that we stand for are making sure that everyone has a voice in this democracy. Income inequality is huge to us. And like I said, it's a general message that resonates with about 99% of the people. The American dream has been ripped out of the hands of working people in Wisconsin. So specifically, what category do we fall in? Well, we're a new independent political organization. So for people who feel that the two major parties have in some ways synced together and aligned in the center, we are on the obviously left side, more progressive area, and we feel that we're going to yank people to the left. So clearly we do have liberal values, but more noteworthy is the fact that we are unafraid to stand up for working families.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. I imagine one question you might get from people who are sympathetic to your ideals might be, why not become Democratic Party activists, work within that party, try to bring these issues there on a party that's already on ballots and already has elected representatives who could tackle these issues?
And we do. In many places, again, we have fusion voting for someone to be considered a Working Families Party Democrat. But, you know, the time is now. We don't have any more time to waste. People are being disenfranchised from voting and even disenchanted, which to me means they're not finding candidates that are exciting to them and represent their needs and values. And so being independent and something new and different allows us to really support champions who will work and deliver on the needs of working families well beyond Election Day. Something's got to change. I mean, it's been really tough to raise a family here in Wisconsin, so we think we bring something new to the table.
Now, you're in a state where Republicans have had a pretty solid run in state elections for governor and for the state legislature. Democrats, fewer successes to point to put it mildly. If Democrats maybe are pulled further to the left by your efforts, does that make their chances maybe even worse going forward?
With that, unfortunately, I totally disagree. I think that we are helping and re-energizing the Democratic Party. We've also seen in the state of Wisconsin a major decline in voters coming out, you know, in elections, whether it be the recall or the recent gubernatorial election. We've got to do something different to get more people energized to come out and vote. And we think our message resonates, and we know it does. Things like universal pre-kindergarten, paid sick and paternity leave for families, as well as raising wages. We just had a great success in New York with the $15 wage for fast food workers. So something we're doing is working here.
You mentioned working on nonpartisan local elections, things like city councils, county boards, that kind of thing. Do you see this maybe as a training ground for candidates for higher offices down the road?
We do, and we think that we can do a better job at that. That hasn't been a strength. It's tough to be all over the place, all over the state of Wisconsin, and fight battles and still win that, you know, farm team and that bench. And me, coming from the Milwaukee County Board on a local office, I know that that's the entryway, and it really has been. I mean, whether we like it or not, that's where Scott Walker came from, was local office, then governor and now presidential candidate. So it's time for us to pull up our sleeves and get to work and build that next generation of leaders.
What kind of reactions have you been getting from fellow progressives in the area and for elected Democrats, for that matter?
It's been mostly positive. Of course, there's questions about being, you know, are we actually a third party? Are we going to dilute any of the Democrats? And I've been able to answer those because that's not the case at this point. But general excitement, especially for working people, and I'll use an example like teachers who have seen so many attacks and changes in this community. People are excited that there is a party that's willing to be out there and, again, be unafraid to stand up for the things that we need to actually move people up in their economic situations.
Marina Dmitrievich stays with us. She is state director of Wisconsin's branch of the Working Families Party. We're finding out about the formation of this party here in the state, what their goals and tactics are.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin needs a new progressive party? If you support progressive politics, what gaps do you think other parties in Wisconsin have left? Marina's compared the group to the Tea Party of the Left. Do you think that's a good idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about Wisconsin's new political party, the Wisconsin Working Families Party. We're talking to State Director Maria Mitrievich.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The party is supporting progressive policies and candidates here in the state. Is this something you think the state needed? If you support progressive politics, how do you think this fits in with the state's Democratic Party? What would you like to see this party focus on? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. We've got Amanda on the line in La Crosse. Amanda, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is the first I've heard of the Working Families Party. I'm an avid Bernie Sanders supporter. I just wanted to get their take on Bernie Sanders running for president as a Democrat. I noticed a lot of their policy positions seem to line up with Bernie's platform as well.
Amanda, thanks for the call. Marina?
Excellent question. So as a national party, we are still considering a presidential endorsement, but I can certainly say Bernie Sanders' candidacy has been incredibly exciting, especially with his racial justice plan that he released today. These are in clear synergy with the issues that we've been talking about. So, you know, he's right on things about higher education, the environment, and again, this racial and economic justice plan. But we have not made a final decision just yet where we'll land in the presidential race.
Well, and Amanda, thanks for the call. Marina, assuming that your party does make an endorsement of a candidate in that Democratic presidential primary, whoever it might be, and if that primary is still a live issue when it gets to us here in Wisconsin, do you see yourself campaigning for that candidate?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, we're a people-powered organization. We work 365 days a year. You know, we don't just show up around elections. So we're known for having boots on the ground and having canvassing and talking directly to people about our values and our candidates' values. So we certainly, if we get involved, we really get involved, and we're looking forward to that.
Thanks for that call, Amanda, at 800-642-1234. Back to our callers now with Jeff in Waukesha. Jeff, hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. More of a comment than anything. I guess I'd like to state that I'm deeply concerned about some of the positions that have been spoken about with the guests. And namely, I'm concerned about the idea that corporations are bad and we need to attack corporations, if you will. I'm firmly in the middle class. I've been downsized, had to change career paths, you know, due to things that happened in the corporate world. But what drives the corporate world are 401k plans, public pensions. It's those groups that are forcing the corporations to, you know, be ruthless and whatever we want to call it, to ensure that they can take care of the stockholders who are, like I say, people that benefit from pension funds or 401ks. So, and I'd like to also point out that most of us in the middle class have our careers because of corporations.
So Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Marina Dmitrievich in on this. Corporations provide goods and services. They provide employment. They feed into pension plans. Do you worry about going too far in attacking them, Marina?
Well, we're looking at corporate Democrats, so people that aren't standing up for the values of working families. But when it comes to corporations and well-known ones where the CEOs are making tens or hundreds of times more than the average worker who should share in those profits, certainly I have a problem with that, and we need to curb that income inequality.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We are talking to Marina Dmitrievich. She's state director of the Wisconsin Working Families Party, a new branch of a national effort just starting up here in Wisconsin. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about the party, thoughts about how it might impact Wisconsin politics for better or worse, and if you could see yourself supporting a third party, this one or another one, given the alternatives provided by the Republican or Democratic parties. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Marina, you mentioned you're starting your efforts in Milwaukee, thought about maybe branching next to the Dane County area. Other areas that you think would be particularly ripe for the Working Families Party?
Well, we've got a lot of working families in Wisconsin, whether it be farmers or blue-collar workers in the Fox Valley. We feel that our message will resonate with people, again, who want something different and who want a party and values that help them re-reach that American dream that's been torn from their hands from either the Koch brothers or Scott Walker himself.
And starting with those local nonpartisan elections, is that what you're up to now, recruiting candidates to begin with to run for some of those offices?
Yes, we are recruiting and training and building political power, and we plan to have a really exciting slate of a number of champions running in Milwaukee County this April.
Now, there have been a number of third-party efforts over the years. The Green Party here in the U.S., not as successful as its counterparts in some other countries. There have been local efforts around the state, I know, somewhat similar to this. We don't have fusion elections here. We don't have proportional representation. Can a party like yours really make a difference?
Oh, certainly. I mean, again, I point to New York, where they just had a $15 increase for fast food workers. I mean, look at President Obama. Any day now, he's going to sign an executive order for paid sick leave for federal contractors. I mean, we feel that we're moving the message. Who would have thought that presidential candidates would be talking about a $15 minimum wage? We think we've been really effective to have that conversation.
Back to our callers now with Jay on the line in Two Rivers. Jay, hi.
Good afternoon. I like a lot of what you say. Seems that most voters don't realize that we've been asked to give up more and more in the last 30 years. And I've usually voted independent or for Green Party. And their platform seems quite similar to yours. And I'm wondering if there's any cooperative action the two parties might take together.
Jay, thanks for the call. Any cooperation opportunities there, Marina?
Certainly. We've had a number of groups reach out to us, whether it be folks aligned with United Wisconsin, obviously labor unions, you know, different neighborhood and environmental organizations. So we're pulling all of that energy together right now. And like I said, you know, when you're working for the 99%, the math is on our side. We just need to get people organized and get them out. And I think we can do it.
Now, one possible objection maybe from some voters, the name working families suggests people are in families or working class. Maybe a lot of new millennial voters, I know both major parties are trying to bring them into the fold if possible. Maybe they're single. Do you think that that name, that description of the effort of the party excludes them?
I actually think that the name is really a good name. We all are part of some sort of family in any way that it is represented nowadays. The modern family is quite a unique one. We know that it could be an LGBT family. It could be a totally different type of family. So we feel that our message resonates with everybody. And clearly, most people are working or want to be working and supporting their family. So the name, I think, just means that either both of our major parties really aren't doing a good enough job at standing up for people who are struggling to make ends meet, and we feel that we can be that voice.
Looking ahead over the next few years, what would success in Wisconsin look like for you?
Right. We're in Wisconsin. If you are not part of the Koch-funded Republican Party, you are feeling very disenchanted right now, and we worry about the future of our state, not just to win it back, but to undo some of the terrible damage that's been done. And there's really the only place to go from here is up. And I think as we rebuild, we can be stronger than ever and bringing new diverse voices to the table. So it's going to take some time, and we'll build one office at a time, one board, one school board, one executive race at a time. And that's how you build political power, which will promote the change so that everyone has a chance at that American dream once again.
One concern nationally, and here in Wisconsin in particular, is the concept of a partisan divide where people on opposite sides of it don't see potential to work together. Are there parts of your agenda, your policy goals, that you could see working with Democrats and Republicans, maybe even Tea Party members on, where you could compromise and come up with common solutions?
Certainly, and I think it's on a minimum wage increase. The studies show on both sides of the aisle that when workers and lower wage workers have more money in their pockets, what do they do with it? Go spend it in businesses and local businesses. This is a way to stimulate our economy, and I think it will help everyone raise up. And this is something that everyone is welcome to join us in. Additionally, climate change. I think we need to all be in this together. There isn't a plan B. There isn't a second Earth out there, and this is something that we can unite on together.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges, potential stumbling blocks moving forward?
Well, certainly it's having people understand that we are an independent political party, and knowing what that means, even though we might not be on the ballot as such, we want to be a brand that you can still go in the box when you vote and say, oh, yeah, that's that working families candidate. I know what I'm getting. I know that person is going to stand up for me and my family when we need it the most. We're working hard to build that brand and, you know, working on resources, growing our staff and our operation. But I think we're going to be able to deliver some victories pretty soon.
Marina, thanks for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Marina Dmitrievich. She's state director of the newly founded Wisconsin Working Families Party. You can continue the conversation. Keep sharing your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.